It's 8 o'clock and you're listening to the regional newscast from KVNF. I'm Patricia Naft. The Colorado Department of Labor and Employment has released its employment outlook for June. KVNF's Laura Pomisano spoke to Alexandra Hall, chief economist for the department, about the outlook.
So Alexandra, what are we looking at in terms of unemployment and job growth?
Well, the unemployment rate across the state dropped 0.3 percentage point as we've had more people reporting themselves as employed in the survey of households, and we saw a slight decrease in the number of people working in the labor force. This decreased the number of unemployed by 9,300, pushing the unemployment rate from 5.8 to 5.5%.
The state's unemployment rate dropped by 0.3 percent from May to June. What does that mean for Colorado?
I try to get people to not put too much weight on a change that occurs in any one month. But what we have seen consistently over the past year and even longer in Colorado is continued improving conditions. We have month after month of strong payroll job growth. Our payroll jobs have been growing between 2.7 and 3% over the year, month after month, which is consistently above the national payroll job growth rate. This job growth in Colorado and this increase in economic activity that's been so consistent has led to improving labor market conditions across the state, even as some local areas lag a little bit behind the rest of the state. This is allowing people to get back to work and putting downward pressure on the unemployment rate.
Why does unemployment remain above the state and national average in the Grand Junction and Montrose areas?
The Western Slope area in Colorado is one of the areas I refer to when I said some areas in the state are lagging behind the state's overall growth. Specifically on the Western Slope, the oil and gas activity that was going on about the time the recession started in the fall of 2008, early 2009, actually buoyed that area of the state and caused it to lag going into the recession because of the oil and gas activity. And there were some changes made in production methods that made the north central, kind of northeast central part of Colorado more attractive to oil and gas developers than the Western Slope area. And this occurred sometime around late 2009 or so, mid to late 2009, where we started seeing a lot of movement out of the area, out of the Western Slope area because of that. It's a pattern we've seen in the past. The Western Slope has gone through a boom and bust cycles because of oil and gas activity in that area. And the unfortunate position that area is in now is still recovering from that oil and gas bust as that development moved out of the area and moved to north central Colorado.
That was Alexandra Hall, chief economist for the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment. For KVNF, I'm Laura Pomisano.
According to new data released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics in 2013, average weekly wages in the majority of U.S. counties were below the national average of $958. San Mateo County in California had the highest average weekly wage at $1,983, and Delta County in Texas had the lowest with $378. In Colorado, Arapaho County had the highest average weekly wage at $1,116, followed by Boulder County, average that was a dollar less. San Juan County had the lowest weekly wage in the state at $463. Wine tours, pony rides, pick your own fruit. Farms don't just grow food. Agritourism is on the rise. In Colorado, from 2007 to 2012, the number of farms making money from agritourism went up by 27%. With interest in local food and farm life growing, farmers are ready to capitalize on the trend. Harvest Public Media's Luke Renan reports.
On a warm summer day, three siblings, Bailey, Brooke, and Blake Bolander, chase clucking hens through the yard at Laughing Buck Farm outside Fort Collins, Colorado. They're soaking in the start of summer vacation with a three-day stint at the farm's annual camp.
Learned how to milk a goat.
How to ride horses.
And I learned how to take care of chickens.
New experiences for kids who've had little exposure to farm life growing up in a mid-sized city. The campers at Laughing Buck get to do the mainstay summer camp activities, play music, arts and crafts, but with an agricultural twist. Snack time is held in a hoop house. The hay barn is outfitted with a playground. The farm's owner, Rosemary Jadell Graff, says the camp basically sells itself.
We just keep adding. We've done one thing and, wow, this is full. Let's add one more. Oh, how about a homeschool class for older kids?
Jadell Graff says several years ago, she unknowingly tapped into a demand she didn't even know was there for on-farm experiences. Laughing Buck started off with chickens and goats, selling eggs and milk, but has quickly turned into a community gathering place.
I think part of it is fueled by the local food movement and the parents who become more aware want their kids to connect to the source of their food.
And they're not alone. In the five-year span from 2007 to 2012, the number of U.S. farms catering to city folk went up 42%, bringing in more than $500 million. In pockets across the country, the local food economy is getting more competitive. There's a real push to know your farmer, whether it's through farm-to-table dinners, sessions on home butchering, or canning classes. If you can draw city dwellers to the farm, they might end up buying something else, like a bar of goat's milk soap or a carton of eggs. Jadell Graff says it's partly marketing.
I think the events are good for that because we have our square dancing. We have a big artisan fair in the fall where we just try to bring in the community, and they're here and they kind of get a sense of what we do.
Public interest just is continuing to not wane on wanting to be reconnected. So some of it's demand driven.
Colorado State University ag economist Don Thilmany says public interest is turning into a real business opportunity for small farms. Instead of relying solely on income from selling their products, savvy farmers can put a price tag on experiences. But farms can be dangerous places. A decade ago, many farmers were wary to welcome people onto the property, fearful of expensive lawsuits after an accident. Now, more states are becoming agritourism friendly and limiting that liability, which means more farmers are finding extra dollars in inviting guests.
You see a lot of policies coming into play where they're going to encourage and try to make it as easy as it can be for farmers and ranchers to do this, and I think that's going to be a win for everybody.
Back at Laughing Buck Farm, the Bolander siblings are finishing up their final day at camp. Their mom, Christy, spent summers on her family's farm in Nebraska, which she says can be replicated at farm camp.
That was always my favorite thing growing up, too, going back for a month every summer and staying on the farm. And I was kind of looking for that same experience for these kids, and here we are.
Bolander says now that she's gotten to know the farmers at Laughing Buck, it'll be hard to stay away.
I have a feeling we'll be back there to buy eggs. Now that we know all the egg producers.
Though, she says, it might be a while before she commits to square dancing. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media reports on farm and food issues and is a collaboration of KUNC and other public media stations in the Midwest. You can find more stories or comment on this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment has identified three additional Colorado residents with pneumonic plague for a total of four cases. The original case identified three individuals, each of whom had direct contact with a previously reported dog that had died of plague. They all had mild symptoms, were treated with appropriate antibiotics, recovered, and no longer are contagious. The initial patient remains hospitalized. The dog likely was exposed to a prairie dog or rabbit with plague-infected fleas in eastern Adams County. Although person-to-person transmission of plague is extremely rare, individuals who may have been exposed through close contact with the four cases have been identified and have received antibiotic treatment or are being monitored for symptoms. Contact your physician if you develop a high fever or other plague symptoms following a flea bite or direct contact with dead rodents or exposure to a sick cat or dog that may have had contact with plague-infected rodents. Symptoms of plague include a sudden onset of high fever, muscle pain, nausea and vomiting, or a general feeling of being ill. Dr. Jennifer House, public health veterinarian at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, gives the following precautions. Do not directly handle any dead rodents, including prairie dogs, rabbits, squirrels, mice, and rats. Keep pets away from wildlife, especially dead rodents. Don't let dogs or cats hunt prairie dogs or other rodents. Don't allow pets to roam freely. Treat pets for fleas according to a veterinarian's advice. Do not feed prairie dogs or other rodents. This attracts them to your property, brings them in close contact with other rodents, and increases the risk of disease transmission. Be aware of rodent populations in your area and report sudden die-offs or multiple dead animals to your local health department. Plague often is identified where there is an unusual die-off of prairie dogs in the area. When an infected animal dies, the fleas leave the carcass to find another host, thus spreading the disease. Most human plague cases occur when humans are bitten by infected fleas. Since 1957, Colorado has identified 60 cases of human plague, 9 of which were fatal. Additional information on plague can be found at cdc.gov/plague. Or call 1-877-462-2911 for more information or to report a dead prairie dog. You've been listening to the regional newscast on KVNF. I'm Patricia Naft. Stay tuned for Go Betty and the Monday Morning Music Mix.